Ida B. Wells and the Beginning of the Civil Rights Movement was presented to the African American Women Scholars Conference. Paula Giddings.
Understanding both the marginalization and the agency of African American women means understanding, truly understanding, the dynamics of this society. So understanding us is also understanding our understanding of everything else, because we are the only group in this country who have had to take everyone else into account, who couldn't ignore anybody. And so when we look at this country through our eyes, we see the history, the coherent narrative that people pretend they can't fathom or understand. Let me explain, just talk a little bit about at least a piece of this by a very specific and concrete example. I haven't forgotten that the name of this talk is Ida B. Wells, the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement. Ida Wells is a person whom I've been living with for a very long time now, who sort of walked into the first chapter of When and Where I Enter and really wouldn't leave. I sort of had to force her. I said, Ida, you know, I do have to talk about other people too. But I promised her a book later, and she agreed. If we ask this question of how did we get where we are, certainly a part of it can be answered through ideas about leadership, and Wells illustrates this to me in a very meaningful way. She was born in 1862 in Holly Springs, Mississippi, to parents who were freed and remarried after the Civil War. This is a very important phenomenon of those of us talking about and communicating about history, particularly in the light of what people say about us and our relationships and family. After the Civil War, slaves voluntarily decided to remarry in freedom those who had been married under slavery, and made, in fact, it was one of the first social decisions that freed men and freed women made. And like I like to tell students, you know, much of our history, and we have to understand that and so we can get back to it, so much of our history has been shaped by our determination to live our lives together. But let me go on with the story quickly. Ida Wells's mother, Elizabeth, instilled in Wells the oldest, who was the oldest, and in her six living brothers and sisters, the importance of education and discipline, church, and the values of family. Elizabeth Wells learned to read and write like so many adults of her generation in order to be able to read the Bible and write letters of inquiry to try and locate family members who had been sold away during slavery. Ida's father, James Wells, a skilled carpenter and son of his master and a slave named Peggy, was also what you would call a race man. James had elected to stay on the plantation after the war and work for his employer, a contractor, now for wages after slavery. When his first opportunity as a black man came to vote in the 1867 elections in Mississippi, his employer tried to coerce him into voting for the racist Democrats. James Wells refused, as so many other men did. And when he returned from the polls, though, he returned to find his carpentry shop locked. So without a word to anyone, Wells simply, James Wells, that is, simply went back to town, bought another set of tools, and quietly moved his family to a house nearby. Now he would work as he voted for himself. He was a political activist. Ida remembers hearing the words Ku Klux Klan before she knew what they meant. She remembered the nervous pacing and palpable fear of her mother when her father was out to late night political meetings. All of this had its consequences in the 1870s in Mississippi. In that decade, it possessed the strongest black political organization in the country. During the 1870s, Mississippi saw two black U.S. senators. Can you imagine this now? Two black U.S. senators. And black men served as the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Education, among other high positions. Many of these people were friends of Ida's father. All of this is to say that Ida Wells, growing up in less than a generation from slavery, grew up with a real, not abstract, vision of black power. And yes, it was black power realized through Reconstruction politics led by white Republicans, but also through the agency of black people themselves, through grassroots organizing and leadership. And what a reference point to know and see former slaves reaching the highest offices in the state, people who had been slaves just a few years before. I think this vision is essential to her ideas about leadership. And by the way, as I will mention, these ideas are also the ones that would alienate some of her peers later on. As you know, Wells subsequently moved to Memphis after her parents died quite tragically in the yellow fever epidemic. And in 1884, she would sue the Chesapeake and Ohio Railway after being told to leave the first-class ladies' car. Can you imagine? And now Wells, now you know my girl, she refused when the conductors came to her, and when two men came towards her, she just braced her feet under the seat of the car in front of her, the seat in front of her, and grabbed on, and they tried to physically extricate her out of the seat, which they finally did. But not before Wells took a big bite out of one of their hands. But she got thrown off that train. And in 1884, in Memphis, Tennessee, at a time of the counter-revolution, when whites were taking back control, Wells would sue the Chesapeake and Ohio Railroad, becoming, by the way, the first African-American to challenge the recent overturning of the Supreme Court. This is a familiar scenario. The Supreme Court had just overturned important civil rights bills. She becomes the first black person to challenge that overturning in a state court. And in fact, in the lower court, she would win, but several years later in appeal, she would lose in the Tennessee Supreme Court. And she was devastated by that decision. I had firmly believed all along that the law was on our side, she said, and would, when we appeal to it, give us justice. I feel shorn of that belief. And just now, if it were possible, would gather my race in my arms and fly away with them. The loss of faith in the law is pivotal to Wells, who would soon afterwards find the true me, as she put it, through journalism. It was this loss of faith that would take us to the edge, then plunge us into the modern civil rights movement. We know that in 1892, a friend of hers, Thomas Moss, a postman and owner of a grocery that took business away from a competing white proprietor, and two of his business partners were lynched outside of Memphis. Wells, at the time, was selling subscriptions to her paper, The Free Speech, in Natchez. And when hearing the news, hurried back to Memphis, where a beleaguered black community awaited her, and where she would launch the nation's first anti-lynching campaign. Comparing her to contemporary leaders, or even the leaders of her own period, the two, of course, most important being W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington, I've always been intrigued by Wells's unique style of leadership in contrast to those men. For she is the only prominent leader that I know who employed the entire array of leadership strategies available to us as black people. First and foremost, of course, she used the power of the pen as a journalist to analyze and persuade, a method that would be used in the next century much more by investigative journalists. She would use that power to talk about what she said the truth about lynching. Lynching had reached epidemic proportions in this period of time. And men, particularly, not just men, women were lynched too, but most of the victims were men, and they were killed with impunity because of the widely held belief that black men were only being rightly punished for their rape of white women. So Wells would meticulously document, talk about work, the circumstances around 728 lynchings over the last decade, sometimes using other newspaper accounts, often by going to the site of the lynchings and interviewing witnesses. She found that only a third of the men were even accused of rape, much less guilty of it. There were interracial liaisons, however, she discovered, but they were consensual and often initiated by white women themselves, as she wrote in the newspaper. Lynching, she concluded, was only a weapon of terror to sustain white supremacy and break racial progress. Just a word about progress. You know, ours is not a history of never having, but a history of things being taken away or let go. And in 1900, when we think about where we are now, in 1900 in Montgomery, Alabama, where there were 2,000 black residents in Montgomery, Alabama, and in 1900, there was in Montgomery 23 black-owned restaurants, a dry goods store, 30 shoemakers, 12 contractors and builders, 15 blacksmith shops, wooden coal yards, butcher stalls, greengrocers, draymen, insurance and real estate agents, a lawyer, a dentist, 400 preachers. Every other person, my Lord. 5 physicians, 2 undertakers, all doing well. So there was a lot of progress to stop in the South, 40 years after slavery. Wells also urged a trolley bus boycott, a trolley boycott, rather, in Memphis to continue until the lynchers were identified and brought to justice. In short time, the trolley car company teetered on bankruptcy. They came to our office and begged her to desist. A boycott in 1892. Taking heed of Moss's last words before he was killed, Wells exhorted black people to leave Memphis, in other words, emigration. Leave Memphis, she said, a town which, quote, will neither protect our lives and property. And some 6,000 people took her advice. And she describes a scene. Ministers took whole congregations. People got on wagons. People went on trains. People walked with their belongings. As she mentions in her autobiography, it threw especially white commercial Memphis into complete chaos. She said, you know how black people like to eat in the restaurants and stuff? That was gone. She said, and you know how we like that we paid everything on time? Gone. Most people went west to Oklahoma, to newly opened Oklahoma territory. For those who stayed, she had some other advice. This was another strategy. Think about all these strategies in one campaign. And this is, I confess, was one of my favorite. As she said, quote, a Winchester rifle should have a place of honor in every black home. When the white man knows he runs as great a risk of biting the dust every time as Afro-American victim does, he will have greater respect for African-American life. She carried a pistol herself and vowed to sell my life as dearly as possible. And so we have a leader who, during one campaign, advocated a panoply of direct and indirect action strategies: boycott, moral suasion, advocacy journalism, emigration, and armed self-defense. Future leaders would be divided about which one, or at most two, to use at the expense of the others. What marks a difference? One of the things I wanted to think about and understand. I think it's the fact that Wells was one of the few leaders whose very real constituency was the black community. I mean, it sounds strange that she would be in the minority in this, but when you think about it, the strategies of most black leaders, whether they are reformist or conservative, is limited by the fact that their first imprimatur did not come from the black community, but from their being either acknowledged or accepted, either acknowledged or accepted by the white community. Consequently, as historian Nathan Huggins once pointed out about black leadership, it's as if black people woke up one day to find a Frederick Douglass or W.E.B. Du Bois or Booker T. Washington as their leader, and they dared not say anything against it. This is not to say that these weren't good or even great leaders. It is to say, however, that their strategies were circumscribed by the process by which they became leaders. And I think it's something that we should think about today. Despite their ideology, none were free to mobilize black power politics. Can't do it where they were, or direct action in a sustained way. None of these leaders were in the position accept Wells in this period of time to call for all the means of protest that Wells was able to foment. This is why, one reason why she stands out. And it certainly is why she was in conflict with so many. I mean, as you know, she's also a co-founder of the NAACP. She didn't last very long in the NAACP. And when you think about it, she would be a little suspect of an organization who would depend solely on the reform of law. She knew about the law. She was in Mississippi when the laws changed in front of her eyes. She had trouble with the National Urban League. She had her own fellowship house. She had her own settlement house, which helped particularly Southerners coming from the South to Chicago, where she settled, and helped them to get employed. What happened when the Urban League comes along is that she loses any kind of support for that settlement house, and it's an important sort of turning point, I think, in our history. Organizations who are capitalized the way the Urban League is very anti-worker, anti-union, for example. They're capitalized by industrialists. And I think one of the things so sorely missing, one of our problems right now in the community, is that we have almost two groups of people, professionals, very few blue-collar people, very few people who've been empowered, could be empowered by unions, and those who are in the expanding poor part of our community, because we've never been able to make a decent living in between. So Wells's first imprimatur, her first legitimation, was from the black community. And so she was free to pursue everything that she could think of, including, by the way, subsequently appealing to English and white American liberals, or the electoral system in Chicago. And of course, we do know the story. She had to settle in Chicago after white mobs had burned her newspaper office down in Memphis, Tennessee, and threatened her with lynching, in fact. Wells possessed a characteristic that few since have had, something called boundary-crossing leadership, the ability to lead various constituencies within the race, for example, all the classes. Wells dealt with every group in the black community, as well as those outside of it, towards one's vision or goal. She was successful. The number of lynchings decreased after 1892. Memphis, which Wells made so self-conscious because of its business image, did not report another lynching for two decades. Her vision, her direct action, her civil disobedience aimed at creating protests and dissidents rather than keeping the waters calm, which is what, you know, conservatives like to do. I mean, that's the problem. There are a lot of things in conservative philosophy that none of us have problems with, self-help and all that kind of stuff. The problem is that one of their stances is that nothing really negative is going on. Everything has to stay calm. Capitalist-like calm, you know? So at the height of the lynching period, I mean, Booker T. Washington is saying, you know, just, you know, make a brick. the public stance, you see, that's part of the problem. Because Booker T. Washington, as we also know, if we understand, you know, how complex all this is, also, behind the scenes, though, supported the franchise, helped black people who were in trouble with the law, but he couldn't do it publicly. He couldn't do anything. I'm not saying, you know, I said this one place, and someone said that I was making Booker T a closet revolutionary or something, which I'm not. He certainly wasn't. But the conflicts and the contradictions come from where your source of power is. Wells took us to the very edge of the beginning of the modern civil rights movement. But racial issues and leadership alone don't make a true, full-blown movement if it is to include liberation. Issues of gender must be part of it as well. For freedom to be realized, patriarchal structures must be undone, and the key to their dismantling are gender issues. You know, power over people of a different race was first learned by the exercise of power over people of a different sex. The latter must be undone before any freedom becomes a reality. And so when Wells just would take us then from the edge into the center of the movement with her issues when she began to speak on gender and sexuality. Like I'm sure many of you, I've been thinking a lot about gender and sexuality, particularly lately, particularly as it affects us in the black community. Of course, it's been very much on the front burner with misogyny in much of our popular culture, unfortunately, with the sexual abuse in our community. With the Hill Thomas hearings, I've been particularly interested in how the issue, how it created a divide in our community. And I was trying to figure out what were the lines of that divide. They weren't class or some of the usual things that divide us over certain kinds of questions. And I finally came to the conclusion that the divide was over issues of our attitudes about sexuality, which are actually issues of feminism. And I'll explain a little bit about that as I go along. But the roots of what I'm talking about is found in the struggle of Ida Wells and her black feminist contemporaries. They represented one phase of the struggle about feminism and sexuality, which must be continued in our time. And to do so, we have to do something very important. We have to end the silence on the discourse about sexuality and gender in our community. Why the silence? Why is it so hard for us? Well, one thing, and certainly understanding what Wells did helps us to understand this as well. We as black people have been largely and negatively defined by our sexual behavior. More precisely, by our deviant sexual behavior, wrongly assumed to be at variance with white middle class sexual behavior. After all, segregation and all of its attendant implications and consequences was based on the idea, not that races per se must remain separate, but that the different sexuality of the races had to remain separate. So sexuality is an organizing principle for segregation and all of its implications and consequences in our lives. For example, in the late 19th century, the time of Ida Wells' campaign, black men were seen as having not necessarily a stronger sexual drive than white men, but having a less controlled and less civilized sexual drive than white men. Black women have been historically perceived, on the other hand, as being diametrically opposed. You know, the men are sort of similar, but different in degree. Black women are seen as diametrically opposed in their sexual makeup to middle-class white women. In the late 19th century, it was believed that white women, for example, had hardly any libido at all. And the way these kinds of attitudes are shaped towards other kinds of needs in the society, which is a whole other lecture, is very interesting, because in an era before that, women's, including white women's sexuality, all of them were seen as voracious. But there are particular needs now for that to change, you know, and we are always victimized by these things. So it was believed that white women had hardly any libido at all. Those who had one was deemed as, well, either prostitute, but there were certainly their sexual urges were inappropriate. And middle-class women who wanted to be appropriate would even go so far. There are two very well-known doctors in this period of time who performed clitorectomies to diffuse these urges. Because if you had the urges, you were in a different class and of a different race. Furthermore, their sexual organs, white women, were believed to be, well, as fragile as they were, which then tempers the behavior of men toward them. In a binary opposition, black women were thought to be brimming with libido. They were considered lascivious and sexually promiscuous. This is not news to us. On the opposite pole of femininity, we, as well as our sex drive, was seen as masculine, which is one reason I think we have some fears. We have a lot of homophobic fears in our community. And what was interesting in this period of time, of course, was that, I mean, racism and sexism has always been around, but became ideology in the late 19th century, was ideology proved by science.